Stand Up with Pete Dominic.
With Pete Dominic.
On Indy, Sirius XM 104.
All right, we are back here on Stand Up, and we are just 90... I am just 90 minutes away from my procedure. The big snipperoo happening at 9:30, or at least that's the appointment time. I wonder what time the snip will actually take place. That's yet to be determined. Dr. Chang is going to have to let me know that. Well, I'll know soon. I'm going to have to talk to our next guest about this. I'm sure he'll try to talk me out of it. He's a professor of pediatrics and director of the Center for Health Policy and Professionalism Research at Indiana University. He does research for a living, and he is also an author of Don't Swallow Your Gum, Myths, Half-Truths, and Outright Lies About Your Body and Your Health, and its sequel book, Don't Crush Your Eyes, They'll Get Stuck That Way. And they've got a new one, a third, coming out very soon. His blog is one of the most popular, and he was just ranked one of the 10 most important healthcare bloggers in the country by somebody, Wall Street Journal? Dr. Aaron Carroll is joining us. Who is it?
How are you? It was like Indianapolis Business Journal, so don't get too excited.
Oh. All right. Well, at Aaron E. Carroll, two R's, two L's on Twitter. Give him a follow. He's about to blow your mind with information. So a lot to talk with you about today. First, let's talk about me.
Okay.
So anesthesia.
Yes.
I'm looking forward to it. Like, what? Sounds like a great drug to me.
Yeah, you won't remember any of it, so it won't be that great.
Will I remember coming out? Will I come out of it? I want to record me coming out of it because I think I'm going to say silly, silly things.
You could try. Some people do that, but, you know, most people probably don't. They just sort of come out of it and then slowly just come back to sort of waking up.
Somebody said, I'm not worried about, like, dying or anything like that, but what some people say they have bad, some guy earlier said he has bad reaction to anesthesia.
That has a very, very small risk of happening, but, you know, that's okay. Why you have anesthesiologists, and they monitor you very carefully, and they'll do things.
No, I mean, like getting nauseous or sick or something like that after.
I mean, you're not getting, like, general anesthesia, I imagine. They're not putting you out and, like, intubating you and doing all of that. You're just going to be, like, consciously sedated, so it's unlikely. You'll
consciously sedated?
Yeah, I mean, it's not like I didn't talk to your doctor, no new procedure, but I doubt they're, you know, sort of putting you completely under and paralyzing you and,
So what is general anesthesia where you,
Like when you get the tube in your throat and it's breathing.
No, I mean, not that one. What is the one I'm getting then most likely? It's just, they pump a milk-like substance into you, right?
You're probably getting, like, I mean, I don't know what you're getting. It could be propofol.
It's a vasectomy. I mean, what could it possibly be?
That's what I'm saying. It's going to be something in an IV, and they're going to say, like, count back from 10, and you'll do something like 10, 9, 8, 7, and then you'll say, when are you going to start? And they'll say, they just finished. And you'll be like, oh, my God, I didn't even know. And that's how it'll go.
And then I'll be out cold.
You won't be out cold. This is the thing. Well, you won't remember it, but you won't be, like, out cold. You won't remember
it. It won't be. It's not like sleeping?
It's sort of like sleeping, but it's being on drugs, man. It's not the same.
So that sounds awesome to me, being on drugs.
Well, except that you won't remember it. It's not going to be like something you're going to remember. It will just be like a gap. Do you ever have your wisdom teeth out? It'll be like that.
No.
No. Oh, man. Have you had any procedure? Have a colonoscopy?
I've had a sigmoidoscopy.
No, you were probably.
They didn't do anything
for that, man.
Yeah, I was wide awake for that.
Yeah, that's a pleasure, isn't it?
Yes, it's awesome. I actually go on Wednesdays now.
Yeah. Okay. You got to call and ask. It's the same kind of thing. It's like they you don't want to remember it. They give you drugs. You're like, oh, really? That wasn't so bad.
Melanie says it's like you got roofied. That's a great thing to say, Melanie.
There you go. Sort of. Except with, you know, hopefully they're doing the right thing to you while you're out.
Exactly.
Depends on your definition of right, I suppose.
I suppose. Yes.
Snip, snip.
Vasectomy for Pete is obviously right.
You've been trying to convince me not to do that.
That's not true. Well, see, now I've not been trying to convince you not to do it. I've been presenting you with evidence so that you could make your own decision.
Well, what's wrong with getting a vasectomy? It's a great idea. I want to have good sex without the concerns.
Nothing at all. The doctor goes.
What birth control are you using right now in the consultation? My second, by the way, because I love going. And I go, nothing. He goes, what do you mean? I go, well, we just, you know, withdrawal. He goes,
okay,
well,
yeah,
that's...
And this is superior to that.
He goes to me, well, that's not very responsible, you know. I go, I don't want to tell you how to do your job, but we're like 614 for 616.
Yep. Yep.
So, I mean, it's not that bad, right?
No, but he's right. You're not, it's not, yes, this is.
But it's not great because I got to, you know, I got to finish on my own. I don't like that.
Oh my, really? Why would you want to do that?
No, I'm saying I have to now.
I know. I'm saying why in God's name would you try some birth control for God's sakes?
Well, exactly. Well, that's what I'm doing.
It's not either. It's not pulling out or.
What, wear a condom?
There are many other forms than besides that, man.
No, that's sexy. Condoms with in a 13-year relationship are fantastic.
Try. There are many others.
All right. Well, I'm getting a vasectomy today at 9:30.
That is your choice. Good for you.
When will the anesthesia wear off? Because I have to interview Ron Paul. I have to do a pre-tape with him at 3.
2015. Wait, what time did you say?
At like 3:30 today, I think.
3:30. And what time is your procedure done?
Probably around 10:30.
Yeah, you'll be fine.
I'm gonna be icing my testicles while I interview Ron Paul.
That's very possible.
Which has basically been a fantasy of mine for a long time to have that happen.
Is there any other way to interview Ron Paul?
Dr. Aaron Carroll is joining us at Aaron E. Carroll, theincidentaleconomist.com, and so the CDC, antibiotics, talk to me. What, and apparently you're on some board regarding this news?
Oh, no, man. That's Kevin Anderson. That's not me.
Who told me that? Well, he's on your blog. But anyway.
I must have misread the good doctor's blog post because fair warning. I sit on the board for that.
CDC report on antibacterial resistance. The CDC just published a comprehensive threat assessment on antibiotic resistance.
Yes.
What are the results?
I got to actually go look because I didn't write.
Estimated minimum number of illnesses and deaths caused by antibiotic resistance. Illnesses over.
This is the problem. I mean,
and what the hell is all this?
Because if you believe in evolution, then what happens is the more we give antibiotics to bacteria and don't kill them off, the ones that are left are stronger because they are the ones that are least susceptible or least likely to be killed by the antibiotics we give them. So by giving them antibiotics over and over again, we keep weeding out the weak bugs and leaving around the strong bugs or the super bugs or whatever you want to talk about them. Since people in the United States and worldwide, we should just blame the United States, keep demanding antibiotics they don't need, many more people are getting antibiotics than they should, and the bacteria are getting more and more chances to.
Who are these people demanding antibiotics they don't need?
There's lots of people that go to the doctor and want an antibiotic for a cold or think that, you know, I'm starting to get a little bit of a sore throat. Give me an antibiotic. I might have.
Really?
And there are a lot. Oh, yeah. And there are lots of doctors also who will prescribe those antibiotics because they don't want to spend the time or the effort or, you know, they don't want to lose the good relationship they have with patients. They don't want to spend 45 minutes arguing with them about how it's a viral illness and they don't need an antibiotic. So lots of antibiotics are being used and they don't need to. Plus, we're putting antibiotics in everything these days. You know, you got to have antibiotics in your soap. You got to have antibiotics in your, you know, your animals. You got to have antibiotics even, you know, sprayed perhaps on food. I don't know. But they're putting antibiotics sometimes like it feels like it's in the water. And so the bacteria are getting too much exposure to antibiotics. And the ones that are left are being super-duper accelerated evolutionary-wise to be super strong in combating the antibiotics we have, which means we have to keep trying to invent new antibiotics to try to overcome the bacteria's resistance to the old antibiotics. And we're running out of antibiotics. So there are more and more bacteria that are being resistant and therefore are becoming a problem. So when we test against it, we can see that they're a problem. And so now there are increased numbers of deaths every year and increased number of illnesses due to bacteria that have resistance to certain antibiotics.
So you're also making a point about evolution there. The bacteria, you're saying... the bacteria that makes us ill, it evolves so that it can't be affected or neutralized by antibiotics. And that, you're saying, is an argument to believe in evolution.
Well, there's two reasons that you could believe in evolution for this. One, you can actually sometimes see it happen. Bacteria are very good at exchanging DNA and RNA. And you can we have seen in like the labs where bacteria have, you know, one gets the sort of the whatever, figures out the DNA to create some substance which makes it resistant, and it then figures out how to give it to something else. The second way is to remember that the way evolution works is that we have random changes in beings. And so Some people might have be slightly taller. Some people might be slightly smaller. Some people might have slightly different color eyes. Or some people might be slightly faster or slightly slower. Well, some bacteria are slightly more or slightly less susceptible to antibiotics. And then when they get exposed to the environment and the weak ones are wiped out and the strong ones survive, which is where survival of the fittest comes from, those are more likely to breed. And that means that the next generation has a higher population of the types of bacteria that are going to be stronger. And the same thing happens again. But instead of happening sort of slowly over the course of many, many years, it's getting very, very accelerated because we keep exposing them to bacteria and sort of wiping out most of the population.
Isn't that, though, Christ's work?
Well, if you can show me how. Well, here's the thing. You would imagine if it was just this, that one, they would just be the way they're supposed to be. They wouldn't sort of gain skills.
You underestimate the power of our Christian Lord. Yep.
Said our. You have to remember I'm Jewish, so that's
you have to remember I'm nothing. So.
Well, but you said our, so I'm assuming he's your Christian.
I know. Because you care so much about research, you have looked into a little bit the gun stuff. I mean, I know I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. I know we could spend hours on it, but I mean, you're the first one to make the argument that we shouldn't be addressing. And I know Eric Siegel made this argument to me yesterday in a voicemail. Our friend Professor Siegel, that we shouldn't be trying to end gun violence by addressing mass shootings because the vast majority of shootings are not these types of mass killings. But nonetheless, what do you take away after one of these shootings happens? How do you think we can what's the best way to prevent this type of thing? Is it a mix of regulations and mental health care? And
I mean, this
is it the video games? Is it, you know,
no.
the movies?
Okay, let's
tell me what research says, because I know you don't react very often emotionally to things, and I do.
It's not the video games and it's not the movies. There's no evidence for that at all. In fact, if there was evidence for it, then there would have been no violence until those things were invented. And there's been plenty of horrific things that have happened in the past without that kind of influence.
They have jumped up, though, since like 2006. We've had a real jump in these
things. And this is where it's like, part of this is that, you know, you have to own that the media, well, let me take it back. The media can be held somewhat responsible because every time you get some real expert from the FBI or something talking about it, they say the first thing that you should never do is publicize this in the media and spend a ton of time talking about it in public, because there's probably very little question that making such a big deal out of it every time is making it happen more often. And since pretty much no one, including it, you know, perhaps now us, because we can't stop ourselves, can stop talking about it. We make that more likely to happen, because, you know, if somebody is disturbed, or somebody wants to end their life, or somebody wants to do something dramatic, they know this is the way to get the fame. And
is there any evidence of that?
Yes, the FBI. There's FBI people when they talk to the people afterwards. I believe that, you know, one of the reasons they cite for why this happens is because, you know, they want their name to be known, or they want something that, the experts, the ones that I trust, say this should not be happening. You know, there are specific ways to talk about it. Don't tell their names. Don't put their faces out. Like, don't make them famous. In other words, it's like if they just talked about the occurrence, but we didn't spend so much time putting the guy's face on Rolling Stone, then that might actually bring this down a bit. But it's not because they were exposed to video games. That stuff is nameless. And so this, where we talk about, you know, the person and make a big deal about it, is somewhat of a problem. And I can't get on the news these days without, you know, they're going to go talk to probably the guy's friends. They're going to go talk to his, you know, high school teachers. They're going to go talk to, you know, did you know? Soon we'll be watching. I remember one time they showed that they found a tape of, like, one of the past shooters, like, playing ping pong 20 years ago, and they put that on the news. It's like, what are we doing? This is crazy. But that's what the 24-hour news cycle demands, because they got to keep finding new things to talk about with what is going on with this kind of shooting. But, you know, if you look at this specific case, it appears this guy had some sort of a criminal record. It appears that he had some sort of mental instability. You'd hope that there were ways to pick up on this sooner. You would hope that there would be ways that people like this would not have access to guns. But, you know, it's going to be the usual probably political game now, where we start talking about assault rifles, even though I think that wasn't even what he used this time around.
No, he used a shotgun.
Right. In which case, it's like, you know, people that want to do horrible things will find a way to do a horrible thing. You could still, you know, put a chain on a door of a building and set it on fire and kill lots of people without ever getting access to a gun. People will do horrible things. But we also know much more about them. This is like it interrupted the entire national media. You know, no more talking about Syria. No more talking about, you know,
the debt ceiling and the budget.
Debt ceiling. No more talking about the continuing resolution or the fact that the government shut down in 2 weeks. You know, this is what we will all talk about now for like the next week. It totally disrupts the entire national conversation, even though the likelihood of this happening to you is near zero, and the likelihood of a government shutdown or a debt ceiling default have, you know, affecting you is near 100%.
What's the likelihood of me dying during my vasectomy today?
Very, 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 very low.
That was five varies, but I was looking for a percentage.
Yes, because it is very.
I said bye to my daughters this morning. It might be the last time I see them.
Well, that's every day, though, because you could get hit by a car or you could get anything can happen. So I sort of don't buy into that mindset.
Well, do you buy into the mindset then that because some four cops got shot at a Starbucks in Seattle in 2009, that I should be carrying a gun at Starbucks?
No, because, again, I think, you know, the likelihood of you if having a gun in your home makes it much, 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 much more likely that your children will get into an accident and wind up shooting themselves than that you will wind up defending yourself with it. So I would personally not. Now, other people want to make a different decision, and this is the United States, and that is their right, but that's how sort of I weigh the calculation. The likelihood of you using the gun to protect yourself, to defend yourself successfully is so much less than an accident happening that I err on the side of not doing it.
This guy on Twitter just writes about my vasectomy. He says, hey, Pete, nothing to it. Frozen peas, comfortable chair, relax, smile, hashtag stand up, hashtag snip, snip, hashtag final fertile moments.
That's the guy you want. There you go.
Yeah, there you go. You're not going to try to convince me not to do this?
No, I'm not going to try to convince you not to do this.
And should I continue to take antibiotics? I didn't finish on that. What's the solution?
Well, here's the thing. It's like I think that putting the antibiotics and wiping them on your hands every 5 seconds is insanity. I think that, you know, I think you should get antibiotics when you have a bacterial illness.
Yeah, we all agreed. Me and Alfred and Chris, and I forget, I don't think Melanie, I don't know if you said Melanie, but we were talking about it yesterday, that none of us do that. I mean, clearly Alfred doesn't because there is gangrene growing on his laptop. He is a filthy, filthy person. But, I mean, none of us do that. None of us are hyper-vigilant about germs because we all believe that that they're healthy to have some germs. I mean, we're not licking the subway pole, but we're not worried about grabbing
it. I am not a germaphobe. People were not dying of bacterial illness and dropping dead, you know, before we had bacterial soap. It's just not necessary. But, you know, these days they put it in everything. And so that is a problem. But, you know, trying to get that back, I mean, they're trying to, like, put it in every animal now as well because they just don't want to, you know, it just makes it so that they don't have to deal with the illness. And so there have been new laws about not doing that in certain places as well. So we just need to use antibiotics correctly. It's not that they're good or bad. Like everything in moderation, they're perfectly great. But a lot of people go overboard. I have friends who call me up for prescriptions all the time. I'm going on a trip I have a cold. This is the only way I get rid of a cold. And I won't fill the antibiotic prescriptions. I won't do that. But, they, you know, they want them, and then they'll go somewhere else.
Your friends ask you to write them prescriptions?
Some do.
Ugh. I've called you 1,000 times. You legally couldn't write me one, could you?
I'm not sure I could. I don't know what New York law is like.
But I would never ask you for that. I'll ask you for advice all the time. But.
I need a – can you just – well, since you got it out, I need like a Cialis and a Provigil.
Thanks. Hold on. Let me write this down.
Yeah, Provigil.
Provigil.
Okay.
And Cialis.
We'll get right on that.
Thank you.
Valtrex for me, please. I mean, for my friend, please.
Speaking of Valtrex, There's a new thing out now. This woman, Betsy McConaughey, who I'm sure you have broken bread with many times, Dr. Carol. Doctors, not Obamacare, will ask you about your sex life. She is saying now that the government is going to be asking you about your sex life and if you're having multiple partners or, in Alfred's case, sex with a guy outside of your relationship, things like that.
I get frustrated with this because, like, first of all, she writes this piece in the New York Post.
Titled, Obamacare Will Question Your Sex Life. And
it's like, and I thought, and it's one of those things where it's like, oh, I thought, oh, it's the New York Post, whatever. And so I wasn't even going to write anything, but I had one or two friends write me. It's like, you got to write about this. And so I did. But, you know, the next thing I know, she's on every news program, and, like, this is making headlines, and it's freaking, like, the top of Drudge. Like, people really believe this? It blows my mind. Let's start at the beginning. First of all, doctors are always going to ask you about your sex life. They're supposed to ask you about your sex life. They're also supposed to ask you if you're depressed. They're supposed to ask if you do drugs. They're supposed to ask if you do very many unsafe things, because part of what we call anticipatory guidance, or speaking to people and preventing risk, is trying to find out what risky behaviors you might be engaging in so we can offer you some advice. Because even when you're a pediatrician, you spend your almost entire month of adolescent in medical school, and then certainly in residency, you know, learning and getting beaten into again and again how you talk to adolescents, how you have to, you know, create a bond and a dialogue with them to ask them these very difficult questions so you can find out when they might be having sex. Are they having safe sex? Are they doing drugs? Are they doing alcohol? Are those things being mixed? Do they have multiple partners? Because there's a significantly increased risk of a sexually transmitted infection, and many of them can kill you. So you need to know what's going on. So when I go to the doctor still, they ask me about my sex, but they always have. And the brave among them will ask if I'm having sex with anyone other than my wife. Not because they want to pry into my business, but because they want to know if I'm having sex with multiple partners and if I might be at increased risk for an infection, and therefore to either test for it or to counsel me appropriately. This is the way it has been forever and ever. And what the law does is say, hey, you know what? There's evidence. Research that shows that doing this kind of preventive care actually works and saves people's lives. So we should pay for it, because why do we pay for so many things that don't work, you know, prostate, whatever, but we don't pay for so many of the things that do, like preventative screening or domestic screening and domestic, all of these things work. So the law says, you know what, we're now going to pay for this stuff. Insurance must start to cover this stuff that we know works. If you're going to cover all that stuff that doesn't, it's got to cover the stuff that works. It doesn't tell doctors they have to ask. It says if you do ask, well, then you'll get paid for it. That's what the law says. So first of all, it doesn't say, doc, you know, you have to do this. The second thing is there's another law called the High Tech Act, which is part of the stimulus, not part of Obamacare. It was passed as part of the, you know, ARA program way back when. And what that does is tell doctors, hey, you really need to get an electronic medical record, and you need to start saving this stuff. And if you get an electronic medical record and you meet certain guidelines, we will give you an incentive payment right now. And it says in the future, we will start penalizing you if you don't have it. So you might as well get on board now, get the incentive payment, because if you don't have it in the future, you will get a penalty and you will lose money. And so what Betsy McConaughey did was conflate these two things together. She says, well, now doctors are going to be forced to ask about your sex life, and they won't get paid unless they put it in an electronic medical record and give it to the government. There's not, like, one bit of truth to that whatsoever. The putting stuff in electronic medical
records, they'll get a bonus if they do it.
She actually said, and they would get penalized. No. She was making it sound like they would get penalized if they don't. Because even a bonus if they do it would say, well, then just don't do it. You won't make a bonus. She said they'll get penalized if they don't do it. So she's conflating all of this together. She's saying the doctors are – she's lying. Well, not lying. Maybe she is. She's saying doctors are being told by the government you must ask about a sex life, which is not true, and then put it in an electronic medical record, which is not stipulated one way or the other. And if they don't do it, they'll get penalized. And today what's happening is if they – they're just – none of this has anything to do with
it. She interviewed two doctors for this. One doctor said he couldn't – he called the sex questions. He's a cardiologist. He called the sex questions insensitive, stupid, and very intrusive. Then he said he couldn't think of an occasion when a cardiologist would need such information, but he knows he'll be pushed to ask for it.
Yeah. Okay. So let's start off with the fact that if you're a cardiologist and you can't think of a valid reason to ask a patient about a sex life, you have no business practicing. Since there are freaking guidelines about when to talk to patients and how to talk to patients after they've had a stroke or heart attack about reengaging in their sex lives, in which case you would need to talk to them about their sex lives and what they're doing and whether or not it would be safe after you've had a heart attack or a stroke. And if a cardiologist can't figure out that that might be a good time to ask about if they're having sex, what are they – I mean, I'm getting excited here because this is just so appalling.
Well, let's calm you down by you asking the sex questions that you think are appropriate to Chris, and he has to answer them honestly. Okay?
No, let's not do that. Let's not.
Why?
Well, what? Because it's like, I think it almost trivializes what, you know, what this is like. This is a serious thing. That part of it also is just bothers me from a professional level. It's like, you know, you get taught in medical school that, you know, patients tell you stuff that they don't tell anybody else.
13 partners.
They tell you lots of things. Well, but they tell you things that they don't tell anybody else, sometimes even right. their spouses, their parents. And it gets beaten into you, and I make light, and I talk about how, like, I'm not probably, you know, the most active clinician in the world. But you take it seriously. It is a, you know, a real privilege that, you know, you develop these bonds over time with patients, that you are privy to their most secret information, and that it is important that this bond exists and that we share it and that it's private and that we protect their information not only by law but by social contract, that, you know, we can't even be forced by the courts to give this information up. You have doctor-patient confidentiality, doctor-patient privilege, and this stuff is sacred, and that bond is important. And when someone goes and writes a piece like this and says, hey, you know what, when the doctor's asking you that question, that's just the government trying to get your information, that's disrupting the patient-doctor relationship. That is putting bureaucrats in the way of doctors and patients. It's trying to tell patients, don't tell the truth about, or don't give that evil doctor your information. And that's how people die. You know,
doctor, a nephrologist, what's that? Nephrologist?
Kidney doc.
Kidney. He says, he's a professor at Albert Einstein Medical College, explains that your medical record should be a story created by you and your doctor solely for your treatment and benefit. But the new requirements are turning it into an interrogation, and the data will not be confidential.
Well, okay, first of all, there's electronic medical records everywhere right now, and they are protected by HIPAA to such an extent that everybody's screaming and yelling that it's impossible for us to get the information to other doctors and such, instead of getting it just to the patient. So if anything, the laws are overbearing, most physicians feel right now, in trying to prevent you from sharing your electronic data even with other people who absolutely positively need it. And the number of forms that we got to get signed before we can release it are enormous. Secondly, there's this mistaken belief that somehow if it's on paper, it's amazingly secure. But if it's in a, you know, if it's in a an electronic medical record, which is password protected and everything else, that it's impossibly safe. You know, it is in many ways easier to sort of, in a broad swath, you know, get huge amounts of data if you're not totally protected or not correctly, you know, stored. But that would be the same thing as saying, if I don't lock down the office and make sure that, you know, that the papers are safe, then somebody could also come in and see them. And I got to tell you, papers get lost all the time. They get misplaced. They get put in the trash instead of the shredder. Your stuff is always at some level of risk. And that you're always supposed to write down this stuff. It happens all the time. You write it on paper. You write these things down. And patients have never, or maybe they do, and we just don't know, but they might have been panicked about this stuff getting out. But we've always done a pretty good job of keeping everybody's stuff where it needs to be and so that it doesn't get out. And it can't be compelled by law because there's doctor-patient privilege. And putting it on electronic medical records, you have to remember the one thing I've screamed about on this show that we don't have is the ability to easily export and import the stuff and move it around. We still can't do that. Even the high-tech law won't allow us to do that. And so it's asking us to start storing the stuff electronically so that we can get at it for the patient's good more efficiently. It is not so that you can give it to the government. There's nothing about giving it to the government in the law. The same laws that prevent them from turning over the paper records are the same laws that prevent them from turning over the electronic records. And if it's your belief deep in the core of your being that someday the government is going to demand and get access to your records, it's irrelevant whether it's paper or whether it's on electronics. They're going to get it. If you believe they're going to send in their jackbooted thugs and go get your records, it's going to happen. And it won't matter if it's on electronics or if it's on paper. They're going to get it.
What does the best science say about coffee? I didn't have it this morning because I'm not allowed to drink or eat anything before my my vasectomy procedure, and I'm dying here. I'm dying.
I
my head is beginning to hurt, and I am exhausted. I won't even need anesthesia. As soon as I get horizontal, I'm just going to fall asleep.
Well, we'll see.
Although I do think that when he opens up my scrotum, I'll.
Yeah,
I'll probably
you'll be begging
wake up
for the anesthesia when you see a man approaching your scrotum with a knife.
It's a knife?
Well, how do you think they get it? They cut the skin.
A laser. I'm hoping a laser.
A laser? Did that's how they cut your skin with a laser? Do they cut sharks with laser beams too?
Maybe a gun?
No,
they shoot it open,
and they open your skin with a knife.
How do they get through that thick, tough scrotum skin?
With a knife, dude. A scalpel.
Through the eyeball, like every other surgery, Pete.
Why does it worry me that the doctor's calling it just a knife? That seems a little pedestrian for my take, especially if it's in that area.
He's like,
I'm just
going to
grab the knife.
Dr. Carroll's like, it's a knife, and I'm thinking of like some spoon spreader or nice butter,
butter knife.
Nurse, hand me the knife. Now hand me the hammer.
I'll give it to you in a second, doctor. I'm just cutting this Salisbury steak for my son.
Ooh, delicious.
Sorry, Dr. Carroll.
No problem.
Is it a scalpel?
Well, I think they start with a scalpel, and then they probably go in, and I imagine they probably like tie off all the things they need to tie off and then snip it.
What would you say to people who are going to have surgery? Because I did it twice this week, one with my daughter's surgery and now one with mine. I watched them on YouTube. What do you think about watching your potential surgery of yours or your loved ones on YouTube?
I wouldn't personally want to, but I don't think it's a problem. I mean, I don't think they should be broadcasting everybody's surgery on YouTube. People are, you should have privacy, but if people want to watch and they don't mind letting people watch, I don't really think there's a problem with it.
What does it say about me that I got aroused watching some of these vasectomy surgeries?
So that is a little problematic, I think.
Okay.
A little problematic for you.
We're going to talk about breakfast, whether or not that's good. Oh, wait, I didn't give you a chance to answer coffee because we started riffing on it.
Oh, coffee. I think it's one of those where in moderation it's fine. You know, it's just that...
What's moderation, though? Because, you know it's weird how when you'll go to, like, I don't know, where is it that they'll give you like a little teacup full of coffee at a hotel or something? And when it's like we've gotten used in America drinking big giant things, gulps of huge servings of it. So is one giant large Dunkin' Donuts or whatever a day or even two?
That's probably fine.
Really?
Yeah.
At the end of my life, I'm not paying for it?
People will tell you if you're pregnant not to do that because there's some evidence that it's not good. But again, it's like you're talking about a very small absolute risk difference.
Really? Okay. Yeah. Well, that's good to know.
Yeah.
I don't feel bad about that. All right, we've got we're going to talk a little bit about breakfast.
Okay.
And then we're going to talk about the efforts to defund Obamacare, a little bit of politics. And Dr. Carroll doesn't like to talk about politics that much, but I got to ask him because he follows this stuff as much as anybody, and I want to get his take on it. And we'll take your calls as well. So give us a call, any calls, questions about anything you've heard about the Affordable Care Act or any other health care questions, give us a call, 866-994-6343. And for a limited time, Dr. Carroll will write prescriptions for opiates for anybody who calls.
Oh.
So just give a call, and we'll be right back right after these words.
America's Next Top Model. Stand up with Pete Dominic.
All right, welcome back to Stand Up. I am Pete Dominic, and we are joined by the most brilliant doctor in all the land, Dr. Aaron Carroll. You should be following him on Twitter, at Aaron E. Carroll. Apparently, he is tweeting during our interview. Gunpacking Lib writes, at Aaron Carroll, are you tweeting while you talk to Pete Dominic? And Aaron Carroll writes him back, of course. And then I tweeted to Gunpacking Lib, aren't you tweeting while at war? This guy's listening, I believe, in Afghanistan. So, but yes, Dr. Carroll can multitask. I've seen him do it. I've been in his office in Indiana University, and he's got like a TV show going. He's blogging. He's tweeting. He's usually giving an exam to a child, or that's what he says.
Never doing that.
All right. So, follow Dr. Carroll on Twitter, please. If you're not, you should be. You've got almost 8,100 followers, 8,096. Who are the four new followers that are going to put you over the top? We'll give them a shout out if that happens during this hour. So breakfast. You're blogging about breakfast at the Incidental Economist. Is it good or bad for you? I mean, do you need a breakfast or not?
It's one of those things where if you want it, have it. But this sort of idolization and fetishization of breakfast is a bit odd. So, I mean, the reason I wrote, I mean, I, you know, everybody wants to lose weight. Everybody wants to sort of be healthy. And I have long said, I don't eat breakfast. I rarely breakfast, you know, especially early in the morning. I have a cup of coffee. I wait till lunch. It's just, I don't need it.
How do you work out?
Do
you exercise in the morning? How do you
exercise? I know. I get up,
morning?
I exercise right away. And then I come home and I've had coffee on the way to work, and that's really it. And then I eat at lunch, and I'm not starving, and I'm not crabby, and I don't need it, so I don't want it. But my, you know, my wife must have breakfast, or you know, she might hurt somebody on the way out the door. And so we're sort of seeing this even with our kids, where our oldest doesn't really care much for breakfast, and the other two must have it. And so this is constant debate: like, do you need breakfast or not?
Breakfast is the most important meal of the day. You have to have the nutrients and
the
energy.
Why is it the most important meal of the day?
Because you need the food. You need fruit and vegetables and toast and orange juice and Lucky Charms. Because that's energy that you need. Your brain needs it to be able to think when you go to school.
And do you think your body has no energy in it when you wake up in the morning?
I think it's got, yes, you haven't eaten in 8 hours or something.
I was
yes.
told that if you go through a long period of time, like after sleeping for 8 hours, then you wait till lunch, that you're instead of breaking down fat, your body starts breaking down muscle, and that you get weaker because you don't eat.
Oh, my God. No, no. To the point till you start breaking down muscle is way later. You are not breaking down muscle that fast. Now, I'm not saying, you know, fast for like 36, 48 hours. We're talking about a couple hours difference. In other words, if you slept late, would your body, would all of a sudden start breaking down muscle? Because you did, you know, you slept in one morning till 11 and got up and had lunch?
I build muscle while I'm sleeping, but I'm also a very unique specimen.
You're special. But so here's the thing. And again, I'm not telling you not to eat breakfast. If you want to wake up and you're hungry, for God's sakes, eat breakfast. It's fine. Go ahead. You should eat when you are hungry. You know,
what does the research say?
Well, let's bring it back up before that. Let's think about evolution, because we come from animals. Do the other animals get up in the morning and have a big, hearty first meal and then space it out till a second meal and then space it out?
I know Tony the tiger does.
No. First, Tony the tiger's fictional. You should know that. But that's not how animals eat. That's not how, like, so again, this is how society has determined we are supposed to eat. Now, like, this is how American society has determined we are supposed to eat. And so we do it, and then we start to try to find ways to justify it. And of course, marketing comes into play, because trying to get breakfast is one of the home meals. So there's a huge amount of marketing and a huge amount of advertising to try to convince you that you must eat breakfast and you must eat certain foods. And for God's sakes, there seems to be a ton of it you're supposed to eat first thing in the morning from like 22 different food groups. But, you know, again, if you want it, eat it. Totally fine. The question is, do you need it? And people will say, well, if you eat breakfast, you're more likely to lose weight, or if you eat breakfast, you're more likely to keep it off. And, you know, they'll even talk about all of these different kinds of, you know, studies and what's been done. And there was a recent study published that sort of looked at all the studies done, and it was really well done. And what they did was they showed how there's a combination of bias and misrepresentation and mistakes along the way that have led people to constantly reinforce the idea that breakfast is the most important meal of the day. Some of this is because they publish a study which shows a small association, and people turn that into causation. And so, you know, people that don't eat breakfast tend to eat much more calories later in the day. That doesn't mean it caused it or that by feeding them breakfast it would stop, but people turn that into, well, breakfast causes this. Then they would start citing that study in the next study and saying, well, there's lots of evidence that shows this already, and now we have another study and it's really not, it's equivocal or this or that, but we know that breakfast causes this already, so we can keep that. And so a lot of bias exists, and a lot of the data is being misread, where we're taking associations and turning them into causation. And it turns out that the overall evidence showing that breakfast is somehow contributory towards weight loss or being thinner is almost non-existent. It just...
Well, I don't think your war on breakfast is going to help you with Twitter followers, although you have now broken through that 8,101 now. So
I
maybe
caught all five breakfast haters.
Let's go to the phones. And what's the name? I can't see it. Something about... You're on the air. Go ahead. Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Oh, hi. Hi.
Sorry, Kelly.
Carol. Hi, Pete. How are you?
Great. Hi, good.
Good, good. Okay, so I've got a question about...
I'm just an hour away from a vasectomy, Kelly.
I know, and I think that's great, because, you know, there's some men who just would not go through with it. And
those men are awful.
Well, here's my question. So my husband and I, we've been together for a long time. We've got several kids, and we're done. No more. So the question is for Dr. Carroll.
You're done with kids or you're done with the marriage?
No, we're done with kids.
Oh, okay. You were ambiguous there. I didn't know what was going on. Okay.
Sorry. No, we're done with kids. No more children for us. So the question is it, quote unquote, easier, safer for the man to do the vasectomy, or is it easier, safer for the woman to get her tube tied, to do a tubal ligation? Which would be better?
If you were having a cesarean section and you were already open, I would argue that it's easier to do the tubal ligation. But if you're both starting from scratch, and this is the way you want to go, I would imagine it's easier to do the vasectomy. But, you know, I would talk to both doctors that do the procedure.
Really? I thought that would be an easy answer.
This is where I'm giving out medical advice, and I'm always going to hedge when I'm giving out medical advice because I don't know the specifics.
I know, but one, you're opening up the abdomen, and one, you're opening up the ball bag.
As
I mean,
I
one
said,
is
I agree.
Clearly
I said
a more vital.
I said the vasectomy. I'm not, like, saying that. I just mean that, like, they should talk to their doctors in case something I don't know about them that would change.
Well, yeah, that's a disclaimer, of course, right, but I mean, generally.
Having said that, there are other forms of birth control which are almost near 100%, which are not as permanent, and those are valid options as well.
Wow.
Right. We actually use the Mirena, but I know that that's, you know, low dose of hormones, and it's been working well for us. But if we were to get rid of that, what would be the best option?
I'm a big fan of the IUD. Pete knows this. We've had this discussion many times. I think IUDs are fantastic.
La, 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 la.
Thank you,
Dr.
Carroll.
Thank you, Kelly. Hey, what is IO7? When
that's the new operating system, man.
And how do I get it? Is it just going to be?
I think they're releasing it today. You probably just go to iTunes and download it.
Is it going to change my entire computer? All my is it going to be completely different?
Oh, I hope everybody's laughing at you right now. It doesn't. It's not for your computer, dude. It's for your phone.
Oh. Oh.
Yes, your iPhone. Yes, this is, remember that you have a phone?
Asking for people who are ignorant, who didn't know. Why are you going to make fun
of me?
Like
you.
I knew that.
Lisa
in Michigan, you're on
stand-up. Hey, Pete. Got to say one thing before I tell you what helped me to stop yo-yoing with my weight. But when my husband had a vasectomy years ago, it was called the no-scapel method, and you could only go to Planned Parenthood for it. And he didn't ever take the pain medication. We went
to
a party that night. And
oh, my God.
It was a piece of cake.
Well, he's a real man.
So don't worry about it. I don't
Yes. Guess what I'm not? Your husband. I can't even put a light bulb in.
No. You're going to be okay.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
Keep thinking the worst, and then you'll say, this isn't so bad. But if someone tells you it's a piece of cake and you're waiting for it, then you go, God, this hurts. But
don't say piece of cake. I'm not allowed to eat. Do you have a question for Dr. Carroll?
Yeah. I just wanted to say that my weight for years used to yo-yo up and down, up and down. And then I started just to have a big old fattening, lots of cheese omelet every morning late. And people would say I'm going to die of cholesterol problems, but I'm a big exerciser. So my doctor said, don't worry about it. And by eating this big old full of protein and not sugar late in the day, it then made me shift to not want lunch until late in the day. Yeah. And I'm not really that hungry at night for the normal dinner time. And then it's already 9:00. I'm like, it's too late to eat dinner. It's getting close to going to bed. I'll just have something light. So I think what it's done is it's not necessarily the breakfast, but by shifting my eating patterns, I then to end up eating something very simple, even though it's later at night, and it drives my husband nuts. You can't eat after 6:00.
Well, Lisa, I wanted to let you go because I love you to death, of course, you know. But I don't want to get too far down, on diets and meals and everything with Dr. Carroll because Dr. Carroll, I've only got a little bit of time, and I've really got to ask you about what's happening with this defunding Obamacare effort. I want to talk to you about that. I mean, just quickly on that. My question is, once this is implemented, do you think that everybody who has been misinformed, a new poll shows that people really don't know what the Affordable Care Act does? Because they haven't been listening to you.
Literally, let's go to the CNN right now. I wrote a piece for CNN on this. Let's see if they've posted it yet.
Really?
Yes, really.
You didn't tweet about it yet, though.
Well, it's not out yet.
At Aaron E. Carroll. Okay.
It is not put. My God, they take forever to post. I wrote this thing two days ago.
Okay.
So, yeah, I think I do think it's somewhat real. I think if you go on the street and ask people about what they're supposed to do, you remember, I think I've told this story before, but you remember, like, you know, back when we were, like, when it felt like all anyone was talking about was healthcare reform. This is, like, back before they passed the law. And we were fighting about the public option. And it seemed like all day, every day, all I did was argue with people about the public option. I'd come on your show. We'd argue about the public option. We'd talk about the various things. And I came home, and I was, like, you know, eating dinner one night, and my wife turned to me and said, like, what is a public option? What is, and I had no idea what it was. And I just was like, oh, my God, you know, here's someone in my house and has no idea. And I realized the general public is not following this at all. They just aren't. We're in a bubble. And we think that, like, healthcare reform is all anyone's talking about and all everyone cares about. And the truth of the matter is that the vast, vast, vast majority of Americans know that Obamacare is either evil and must be destroyed or, you know, they're sort of ambivalent about it because no one on the left is really pushing this as, like, it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. And so if you ask people, like, hey, you know what an exchange is? They don't know. If, you know, hey, do you know what's going to happen, how you're going to get insurance? They have no idea. No idea, especially since, you know, the whole implementation budget, which was supposed to be upwards of $500 million, got cut. The Republicans cut it. And if you remember back to when Max Baucus made that line about a train wreck, he wasn't talking about the law. He said, if you don't get people to know what this is, if you fail and take the money away from telling people how this is going to work, then we're going to have a train wreck. This is what he was talking about, that if you don't have the implementation money and you don't advertise and you don't have people out there talking about it and you don't have the PR campaign, people won't know what's coming and no one will have any idea what to do, and that will be a quote-unquote train wreck. And it is, because the vast majority of people still don't. I talk to people all the time where they're like, what am I going to do? My questions are always the same. What state do you live in? How much money do you make? Let's look it up on the poverty line. You're either going to go to the exchange or you're going to get Medicaid and you're going to get the, you know, a subsidy and this and that. It's the same answer every time. Or you can go to the website every single time. But people don't know this. And I don't know what's going to happen. I imagine they're going to really try to step up the, you know, sort of outreach and everything at this point. But it is a problem where a large number of people still have no idea how this law works.
But when... Okay, but when they start taking advantage of it, my question is, those people that are the most afraid of it, the most opposed to it, in the reddest of red districts in America, if they end up taking advantage of it, will they then, do you think then minds change on what it is?
Yes. I think, you know, once people start
getting... The way that Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, I mean, yes, that happened. You've talked about
it. Absolutely. I think this will be the same. Part of the problem is that... we passed Medicare, we passed Social Security, and while one half of the country didn't like it, there probably was not as much active sabotage. You know, the idea of, like, let's kill it. It was more of a resigned, okay, this exists, let's see what we can do to change it. So, you know, at this point, they got a large part of the country that still believes somehow they can completely and utterly undo this now. You know, after... they've, you know, lost in the law, and after they lost in the courts, and after they lost in the election, they still think that they can, as a minority, and a reasonably small minority pushing really heavily for repeal at this point, they still think they can nullify the law. And so they're doing everything in their power to fight it, and it is not as if the other side can turn around and say, all we're going to do is support it, because we have to talk about a gun shooting in the Navy Yard, and we have to talk about Syria, and we have to talk about everything else that's going on. So it's an odd sort of novel way that the battle over this is being fought. And that being said, I think we're seeing a lot of angst right now from people that want to kill the law at the last second, because once people see how the exchanges work and once people see that they're going to get Medicaid and they didn't have it before and that it's not costing them what they were told it was going to cost them and it's, you know, they actually have health insurance now and it's more comprehensive than they've had before, I don't think people are going to hate that.
All right. Let me play Mitch McConnell for you and get your response to it. Here's Mitch McConnell yesterday on the Affordable Care Act.
Well, one thing all Republicans agree on is that we think Obamacare was the worst piece of legislation in the last 50 years. All of us have voted to defund it, delay it, pick it apart in one way or another. We know it's wreaking havoc with the American economy. We have a record number of part-time employees now as a result of Obamacare. Insurance premiums are spiking. I think it's safe to say every Republican thinks it was a huge mistake and would like to get rid of it.
All right, so do we have a record number of part-time employees as a result of Obamacare, or is it, like Chris said earlier, as a result of greedy business owners? And what about insurance premiums spiking as a result of Obamacare?
Well, see, he's combining a thousand.
Are either of those things happen, and A, and B, are they, are they correlated?
Obamacare is not wrecking the economy. Obamacare has not resulted in the spiking of insurance premiums. Obamacare has not resulted in, like, records of part-time employees because, you know, there have been lots of studies that show that part-time employees have not actually gone up. And, in fact, the number of full-time employees has gone up more. It's like all of this is in the same way they call it a job-killing program. When we know that it's not forcing people to become unemployed, it is allowing people to voluntarily exit the labor force. It's Betsy McKay again. They're merging everything together and throwing a lot of stuff in a pot and trying to link it all together and then just being wrong about it. It will raise some taxes. It will increase healthcare spending because giving billions of people insurance costs money. It will hurt young, healthy people who want to buy crappy plans for very little money and have no risk. They won't be able to get those anymore, and they will be forced, meaning, or face a financial penalty, to buy a more comprehensive insurance plan than they might otherwise have liked. And so that, if you don't like that, so be it. But it is not this awesome, job-killing, socialistic, totalitarian ball of evil, which is just bearing down on the country and is the worst thing that could have ever happened, ever. That's just not the case. Otherwise, Massachusetts would have broken off and fallen into the ocean some time ago, as would pretty much every other country in the world. And, you know, this is still leaving us with one of the most privately oriented systems in the world. This is the thing, is everyone thinks this is socialism. This will still leave us with arguably one of the most private-based insurance systems in the world, period. And we will rank near the top still, even amongst those that can call themselves somewhat private. But this is political rhetoric, and this is sort of where it has come to. So it is one of those, the only way, I think, for this to finally make that case is for it to happen and for people to see it. Because these arguments were made before Massachusetts, they were wrong. These arguments were made before Medicare, they were wrong. These arguments were made before Medicaid, they were wrong. This is just how it goes. And, you know, until it actually happens, we won't have it. And it's just an interesting exercise to always remember that Ronald Reagan predicted that Medicare would be the end of freedom. He had that line about, like, someday we'll all wake up and realize, you know, we'll talk about how when we once were free. And today, do you see any Republican members arguing that Medicare's got to go because it's a socialistic, totalitarian ball of evil which is going to end freedom? No! No one says that. But that was the rhetoric right before Medicare was passed. That is the rhetoric today, right before Obamacare is passed. But nobody is willing to sort of just point out that fact that this has been said before. The sky was falling. That's what Chicken Little said, and it didn't happen. This is how it went before. This is how it will go again.
You're having lunch with the real John Green?
I had coffee with him like a couple weeks ago.
He's got over a million followers. Can you get a tweet from
that
guy?
He's got a gargantuan amount of followers. Man, it's
huge. Did he hook you up?
He didn't specifically hook me up with followers, no.
He's got a tweet for people to follow you. That's bullshit. All right.
I don't think that's how it works.
At Aaron E. Carroll. Thank you, sir. We're out of time.
Thank you. Bye.
All right, I'm off to my vasectomy. If I'm not here tomorrow, it's because I died. Think for yourself. Look everything up, and we'll talk to you tomorrow, hopefully.